You're listening to Potluck, the podcast that stirs up a unique flavor of people, culture, and brands in Asia. Hosted, as always, by Scott and Drago.
Hello, and a warm welcome back to Potluck. I'm Scott, and as ever, I'm joined by the rare breed Bulgarian, Drago Durov. Drago, I was actually recently watching How to Train Your Dragon 2 with my kids, and they pointed out that not only does the bad guy look like you, he's even called Drago. So we're curious, is he any relation?
Oh, wow, Scott. Well, first, thanks for bringing that up. I'm very happy to report that, you know, the kind of approach that we have to dragons, the narrative, I feel, has evolved. I think traditionally we used to think of, you know, taming dragons, or even some people would go as far as say break dragons, yeah? So I think things have evolved. Clearly the kind of power dynamic hasn't changed. We're still talking about training dragons, yeah? But I think we're moving in the right direction, yeah? So thanks for that. And two, second point, yeah? Little known fact, you're talking about, you know, breeds and relations, yeah? Little known fact, dragons, very promiscuous. So it's perhaps too early in the morning to talk about, you know, the genealogy of dragons. But it may not be too early to talk about the genealogy of the marketing, advertising, comms industry. We have the perfect person, the perfect insider to bring us in on all of that. Today we have Jocelyn Tse.
Hi.
Founder and lead strategist at MMSN, now based in Shanghai. Previously in various strategy and planning roles with DDB, Leo Burnett, TBWA, Ogilvy, FCB, JWT and Isobar, moving between Hong Kong and Shanghai. I think we're going to run out of time if we mention all the awards that she's collected along the way. Now, a brief intro into MMSN. It's an independent network of strategists who bring together experts, retail, commerce, experts from various areas of expertise across marketing to deliver towards client needs. And I think her LinkedIn page brings all this to life very well, where she says, as an antidote to traditional working models, we understand a one-size-fits-all approach. Linear thinking, siloed expertise, it can no longer deliver on the efficiency and effectiveness that today's complex market landscape demands. Jocelyn, thanks so much for coming on.
Oh, hi, I'm Jocelyn. I think you've done a pretty thorough and good introduction of my background. I for people who aren't familiar with what I do in my industry, so in essence, I am in the broader scope of advertising and marketing and communications industry. For many years, I've been a strategist. And what we do essentially is to observe the world, observe the world and identify market trends, business trends, trends in people's lives, and bring that in into driving creativity and, more importantly, helping our clients' businesses grow. As you mentioned, I've been with many different agencies, I've learned a lot from that. And as a result, I am now doing something quite different from my usual environments of creative agencies.
Thanks, Jocelyn. That's a really nice sort of prelude to the rest of the discussion. As a slight twist or build on that intro, if we think of your journey as a strategist or indeed as a person, what would you say are like the three main ingredients, or, you know, what's been central to that recipe, if you will? How would you answer that?
I stress a lot about being human in everything that we do, because at the end of the day, we're selling things to human beings. Despite, you know, currently there's a lot of emphasis on technology platforms and, you know, various forms of media, but at the end of the day, we're reaching to actual human beings with skin, flesh, and bones that are making decisions, and we're trying to convey them. So for me, compassion is really important, to really understand people's lives, what they think, and being in their shoes. That's one. And second is, because what we do, it's not it's never a fixed solution. It's unlike law, medicine. It's always there's always a fixed answer to a certain problem. For us, there are many, many different solutions to what we need to do. So there's a lot of exploration and trying things out. So the second ingredient is curiosity. Being curious with, you know, what else could be done? What's a better solution? What else is out there? And having that sense of wanting to know more and using that information to help our work. And then last ingredient, obviously, wine. Wine is important. Wine as a metaphor. I mean, I love drinking wine, and as a metaphor of being with other people. So my colleagues and even my clients, at the end of the day, they're just people trying to excel at their job. So treating them as a counterpart on that level is really important to me. And I've built relations, really good relationships with my colleagues and my clients through time by just seeing them as a regular person.
Okay. So how does the wine come back to that then? Is that about something around the refinement or the good things coming to you know, mature over time?
No, I think it's more like being able to have a good time and spend time with these people you're working with that is not about work, outside of a work occasion.
Yeah, fantastic.
Great. So the three C's of Jocelyn Tse, yeah, we have C, compassion, C, curiosity, and C, community, yeah? That's
yeah.
Great. Okay.
Or Chardonnay, I think it was, Drago. So before we move on to the next item in the menu, just a quick word about what the actual menu involves. So in season two, we've been splitting each interview into smaller chunks. So we have part one, Lifting the Lid on Asia, part two, Hacking Humans, and part three, Brand Burns. Each are launched standalone, but we also have the full feast edition where you can hear the discussion with Jocelyn in full.
Great. So let's start Lifting the Lid on Asia. Jocelyn, we would like to tap into your unique perspective of what's happening in our region. Now, we know you've spent your childhood in Canada. You've been to university in Canada. You've been back and forth between North America and Asia. What sort of perspective did that bring when you came to study here and then when you were working in Hong Kong and later in China?
For what I do, especially looking at whether it's the market or human behavior, it's always good to have being in a third person perspective and looking at things from a broader macro perspective. When you're too deep inside one thing, it's really hard to dig yourself out and look at things from a broader macro level picture. So that helps me a lot. Also the sense of cross-culture comparison. You have a different perspective. You always have a different perspective on one place after you leave it. Every time I leave China, I have a different perspective on the market. Very different from when I'm actually working there. Similarly, Hong Kong as well. So having this international background actually helps shape the way I look at things differently compared to other people, I guess.
Okay, fantastic. So do you think that in your role as a strategist, this has also been, helped you understand better people and culture, not just in Hong Kong and in mainland China, but also the way you approach understanding people in other markets?
Absolutely. I think even the way my colleagues and clients think and their way of things in different markets, I think it helps me understand them on that level as well. There are fundamental differences in how we behave and think. My favorite book, it's called Geography of Thought. If you're interested, please go read it. It's super fascinating. It identifies a main difference between the Eastern world school of thought versus the Western world school of thought. And it goes back to history from, you know, Greek culture versus ancient Confucius culture and how that has influence rest of the different countries in Asia, and therefore collectively in Asia, there are certain commonalities in the way we think. I find that super fascinating. So I'm huge on cross-culture differences.
Just to build on that, Jocelyn, how do you feel clients respond when, well, for example, do they see your kind of cross-cultural background as something that you know brings extra value to the table? Is that something you kind of touch on at all? I mean, obviously Drago and I come from different continents working in Asia, but we don't have that kind of those sort of Asian roots in the same way. Just curious how that plays out in terms of the way you're kind of seeing the value you bring versus say somebody that's born and raised in China, for example.
Mm-hmm. So I don't think clients and the colleagues I work with are as academic as why I love the books Geography of Thought, but on a really basic level they're always curious about what's going on in, for example, people in other markets. They would be interested in what's going on in China. I'm actually working on a lot of projects with boutique agencies in Europe and New York. All of them wanting to learn what's going on in China because it's so much going on and it's ever changing. Similarly, people in China, they're very curious about success formulas from Western countries and learning from them in terms of brand building and using brand building to build their business in a long-term perspective.
Okay. Yeah, interesting. I mean, it's not too dissimilar, I think, to some of the work that we would do. We're obviously working sometimes with global brands, curious about the and also as you say, boutiques who may be working from other markets and perhaps want a sort of foot on both sides in terms of relatability and bringing that kind of global and local perspective. So yeah, that's interesting to hear. I think we wanted to deep dive a little bit further on the Hong Kong versus Shanghai contrast. So we know over the last 15 years, you've kind of worked on several roles on both sides, if you like, in Hong Kong and Shanghai. So we wanted to have a little bit of fun with that, a bit of a quick fire comparison of the two from your perspective. I guess maybe professionally or personally or both, you can answer these as you want to. But let's start with fun. Let's start with if we're comparing Hong Kong and Shanghai as places to sort of carry out the craft of being a strategist, which would you say is more fun in that regard?
This is a really big question. First of all, what's fun? I was talking to another an old colleague of mine the other day, and we were just talking about how on the outside a lot of people think our industry is super fun. We meet celebrities, we're doing fancy shoots, stuff like that. Actually, on the contrary, we're forgetting to have fun with what we do, and things have gone too serious. There's a lot of emphasis on revenue, building businesses, and we forget to have fun, or even this emphasis on getting awards. That's something I try to bring back into the offices that I work in and people that I work with, especially with my team now. There's a reason why they're also not in an agency environment, simply because they want to do something that's more fun. However, if I really need to answer this question, I think China is probably the place where I would have more fun, simply because there's a lot more going on. Some people would see that as a challenge. Oh my goodness, there's so much happening. How do I wrap my head around all of this? But then for me, anything that's challenging is fun. Without challenges, things are stale and the same. So in that perspective, I think China always offers a little bit more fun than Hong Kong.
Interesting, because actually the second part I was going to ask, which was the more challenging or fulfilling for you, and it sounds like China is the answer, but perhaps you could elaborate a little bit more on why you find China to be that challenging, sort of fulfilling, or maybe not, maybe it's challenging, but is it fulfilling? So yeah, tell us a bit more about that in terms of China versus Hong Kong.
I think both markets are challenging in really different ways. So China, it's like I mentioned, it's the market landscape. There's so much going on that's driven by new technology, and people's lives are changing and redefined by technology, basically. So the challenge there is to really be up to speed with everything that's going on. There's a new product, as in technology product, that is launched every day, basically, on different platforms, on WeChat, on Taobao, et cetera. However, looking back at Hong Kong market, the challenge here is how do you move a sleeping giant? We've been kind of doing the same stuff and kind of comfortable doing the same stuff for many, many years. So how do you kind of shake things up? So it's another kind of challenge here. Any kind of challenge for me is great because challenges are, you know, the other side of looking at a challenge are all opportunities. So if you're able to crack the challenge, then, you know, it always leads to something great. At the end of the day, if you have to compare the two places, Hong Kong is a much smaller market, and our lives are much less diverse than, say, compared to China or even other countries around the world. So one challenge that I always face is, you know, there's really just maybe three insights around people's lives in Hong Kong, and my challenge would be to find 1,000 different ways to repackage the same three insights.
Okay. Are you able to share what those insights are, or are they planners' secrets, or what would you say, or even one of them?
I recently read someone's blog, and you know, someone wrote an article about 10 insights you should never use again for Hong Kong. So one of them is the sense of not being able to see the future. Another one was about Hong Kong. There's this whole lion rock spirit. Hong Kong people kind of work for themselves and strive hard to make things on their own. There are all these things that we know about Hong Kong people that has not changed. And therefore, you know, as a strategist in the marketing world, we have to find different ways to repackage the same things.
Mm. Mm. They're kind of like cultural truths or cornerstones, but they're not necessarily going to reveal anything new or exciting or you know, mm-hmm. how a category is unfolding. Or yeah, okay. I mean, the third angle I was going to ask you about, Jocelyn, was around creativity and how the two compare on that front. But perhaps what I'll do is I'll tee Drago up for the next question in that regard to shift the conversation.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, creativity is a very interesting one for me personally. But I have to say first that I'm a big fan of the geography of thought myself. Yeah, so one of the things that I learned from that is the kind of what it's opened my eyes to the importance of context in Asia. Yeah, so it's important that I build up this conversation around creativity. We know that there have been a number of different papers, lots of data that show the strong connection between creativity and effectiveness. If you think of the work of Les Binet, of Peter Fields, the IPA case studies, yeah? But I have the sense that it's all been very West-centric. It's not clear, really, how much of the data they're using in these studies used to demonstrate the role of creativity is from Asian markets, or China, for that matter. At the same time, MasterCard CMO Raja Rajamani, in his recent book, Quantum Marketing, he claims that we need to be more like China, yeah? So where the focus is more on product, on platform, on influencer relationships. So, you know, product, channel strategy, distribution, the harder aspects, if you will. So who is right here? Is it that creativity works in the West but not in Asia? And if so, why is that? Or are we really talking about a completely different concept of creativity here? It's a very kind of very heavy, very loaded question. Where would you like to start unraveling this from?
I like the third statement that you just made. Is it about a different kind of creativity? Because
right.
I had a really long conversation with an old colleague. I have a lot of old colleagues, sorry, the other day about creativity. And When I first went to China, I struggled, and I even had a conversation with a really important client of mine about creativity, because we were just not getting work the way we wanted, because our minds were benchmarking with work from the US, from Europe. And we were just not getting the same kind of work in China. And then we even talk about education system. Back in the day, people were not allowed to be creative in school, you know, kind of the cookie cutter way of being educated. However, I'm starting to feel that people's receptiveness to creativity might be different in different markets. So in Western markets, you would see more storytelling kind of creativity. And your kind of creativity that kind of touches the heart, it's more emotional. Whereas in China, people are more receptive to, or people have time for creativity that catches their attention, catches their eye, it's talkable, it gets them excited. So I think, you know, creativity works in everywhere. You know, creativity always, if found a good way, always helps drive business. And this is my role. And it's just a matter of how is it then used as a vehicle and then expressed in the right way in different markets. And as a result, you see a lot of really exciting stuff going on in China. Really quirky kind of stuff as well, because, you know, people are probably more receptive to that kind of creativity.
Okay, so quirky is something that, can give them some kudos in a social context if they share, if they talk to friends about, compared to kind of the more personal experience of creativity in a Western context, as you said, yeah?
Joshua, is that also about salience, like standing, like, you know, cutting through the clutter, whatever terminology you want to use? But, you know, if we look at China and the sheer volume of digital, you know, social noise, if you like, is there something about having to have that immediacy and that kind of hook, if you like, you know, in any form of content or comms or?
In my very humble point of view, to some extent, yes. Because people, I mean, we talk a lot about short attention span and lack of time everywhere around the world, but then this is especially true in China. There's just so much going on, and we're still, it's just still a market in very much an exploration phase. People are just trying to discover things they love, and it's still a journey of getting to understand ultimately what they really love and who they want to be, what they want to do in life. So therefore, there's a burst of things that would stimulate them that way to discover and explore and get a sense of excitement that way. And there's a lot of content, brands doing different things. So to your point, it's really important to cut through the clutter. And even if it means I only get half a second of their attention, that's already considered success to some extent.
Okay, which I think brings us nicely to your current role. Or, you know, the last kind of couple of years, you've been working under this MMSN banner, which is effectively a kind of a collective with you at the heart of that. So we're really curious, and as people that also work, you know, in various kind of collective circles, can you tell us more about why, you know, having worked for the likes of your Ogilvy's or your JWT's, you know, many leading agencies, that you followed that path in recent years, and what do you see as like the merits or the kind of, you know, the virtues of that type of model?
This is actually a reaction to things that I haven't been able to do historically in agencies that I was at before. I don't know if you remember, maybe over 10-15 years ago, there was the start of a conversation around integrated models. So more traditional agencies want to be more quote unquote integrated. However, that actually never really happened. You know, even though they bring in different entities to help them be more integrated, but then internally it was always in silo. They had different P&Ls, etc., and nothing was really actually integrated inside. And another observation that I had was the at previous agencies, the way of working was always very, very linear. It was, you know, someone goes and meet the client, gets a brief, and then the brief sits on the desk for a few weeks, by the way. By the time it gets to me, it's crunch time. I have, you know, 2 days to form a strategy, and then we have to quickly then hand it over to the creative guys to come up with something. It was very linear, and there was no sense of collaboration, and ultimately it was also very inefficient in my view. Okay. So with years of being in environments like that, I just felt like, you know, we are in a world where there's so much going on at the same time. We cannot afford the luxury of time to work in that way anymore. So and also because of the complexity of our markets, especially in China, there's no way we can have experts in every granular types of marketing models in China in under one roof anymore. So the idea of the collective is to pull in experts when needed, and custom make a team to really address the client's need.
Fantastic. So you already alluded to that being perhaps apt for China. I mean, do you to take that a step further, do you see the collective model as almost being a kind of a benchmark or a sort of identikit for moving forward in China in terms of how you need to kind of react to a market that's constantly taking new directions and, as you say, requires very specialist types of expertise in certain platforms and technologies?
I see this model actually growing. I have a lot of friends leaving bigger agencies and starting on their own with a similar line of thought. I do hope that eventually this would be a broader trend and larger organizations would pick up on this model. Because at the end of the day, similar to what I do, the guys that I work with, I don't own them. But then what I own is a curation of their work. And I think the role of bigger organizations like a creative agency would have to do that as well. I don't think they can have everyone in-house. I think it's totally impossible. But then their value comes from curating the work. I do hope that eventually this becomes a broader trend and agencies that I was once with and that I love could reshape their business that way as well.
I really like the sound of it. It sounds like it's Jackson Pollock time. Time to...
I love the visualization of that.
Throw things in. Just to make a change to disrupt things.
In part two of our discussion with Jocelyn, we turn to hacking humans. This is where we roll up our sleeves and talk about the shortcuts, hacks, and tips our guests have for understanding real people and culture. Jocelyn, as a strategist jumping between different brands and categories, what would you say are your own hacks or maybe go-to approaches for getting to grips with people, the cultures they're part of, perhaps especially when you're trying to get to grips with a new client or category and you really, you know, need to get your head into the space? So, yeah, what would you say are those hacks, if you like?
I don't know if this is really a hack. It might be common sense to some people, but then also a reminder, because I started the whole conversation about me emphasizing on being human. And this is always my rule of thumb in everything I do. So the hack here really is to be them. I always tell my team to step into people's shoes and live their life a little bit. And then immediately you get a lot of information and you get a sense of how people's lives are really lived, what they're thinking, what they're using, what they're looking at, et cetera. So that's one thing that is so easy. And at the same time, you get such rich understanding into people again, but just by being human and being one of them. And I think this is especially relevant to a market like China. There's no way you can learn about everything in China through reports and data points and reading stuff on your computer. But then by going out there and spending time with people and, understanding what other people are doing in their lives and the platform they're using is the best way to learn. So immersing into culture is, I guess, a hack. But then, again, I wouldn't really call this a hack because it's actually very basic at the same time, but then we kind of forget about it.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that was something I was listening, as I mentioned before, to a strategy podcast, and they were talking about perhaps, you know, there's this sort of sense of hiding behind, you know, pulling comments from social listening or a convenient data point. But actually that's that sort of pure art of just getting out there, observing, you know, immersing. And I guess I'm just curious, like, if maybe you could bring to life an example of what you mean when you say that. So for those that maybe aren't working in our fields, you know, what does that look like for you? Does that have to be like formal research, or is that simply, you know, going to places people are? And, well, you know, maybe you can give an example of what that might look like for you if you're trying to get your head around something.
This example is quite interesting because it's quite offensive to what you do. So the best insights that I have ever gotten, if, you know, based on a more traditional research format, is when the moderator leaves the room and then authenticity comes in. People are actually chit-chatting, and then, you know, those are pieces of gold that we actually get when the conversation is less choreographed and there's not someone trying to talk to them with a hidden agenda. I think when things are natural and in an authentic setting, then you see the real behaviors and real lives of people. And then at the same time, you talked about, you know, looking at social media, doing social listening. What's really missing there are the expressions on people's face when they're looking at something, when they're hearing something, when they're interacting with a product, you know, the lift in their eyebrow, or that, you know, kind of frown on their face. These are all parts of insights as well.
Can we dig in a bit deeper into this dichotomy that you've been talking about? Yeah, that, so having on the one hand the more fundamental, traditional, the, you know, for to some, the truisms of a culture, if you will, on the one hand, and then you have the kind of the more dynamic, what's changing, the trends, the topical stuff. Yeah. And we know, you know, again, it is a truism how fast paced, how dynamic, you know, China is. But over the course of your career, it's kind of your career has coincided with the explosion of digital, of e-commerce, mobile payments, social, you know, each of these are kind of a meaty topic in its own right. But can you talk a little bit more about how, you know, the way the two kind of, you know, play with and against each other at times, but perhaps how they found their way into your approach to strategy? What has really changed for you?
A lot has changed. I was trained as a more traditional brand planner. So when I first started, the way of doing things was to look at, you know, spend a lot of time, look at deeper human insights, things that transcend through time. And then, okay, let's see how that meets things that are trending in our lives currently. First is the way our clients' expectations, along with the market dynamics in the market and people's lives. I've kind of flipped that around now. It used to be, you know, the approach used to be quite linear and also kind of a top-down approach, and then I flipped that around, and I find it very useful to really understand, you know, what's exciting and what's topical, what's trending, and then ladder back into a bigger strategy or even a deeper human understanding. I think, you know, there's a lot of little nuggets of gold when you understand people's behavior on a more granular level and in different channels, different moments of time in their day, and that actually leads into something bigger and more profound.
That's very interesting. Being able to discover these nuggets of gold and being able to tap into the richness of that, is this something that you see unique to China or even Asian markets in general? Does it apply to some markets more than others, perhaps?
I think it's more applicable to being in China and informing strategy in China, simply because lives are so fragmented and the things that we use are kind of all over the place. But to your point about Jackson Pollock, it's pretty much what China is right now. So it's really, you know, going out there and to collect these smaller data points or understanding of human behavior and consolidating back into a bigger picture. I say that about China because if you look at Hong Kong as a comparison, our lives are less, I mean, our media landscape is a lot smaller in scale and a lot less complicated. There's A, B, C, D things that we use. We have our TV screens, and then we have Facebook, and then we have Instagram, and then we have one or two food recommendation platforms. That's about it. So it's a lot less fragmented, and people are quite unified that way. But maybe eventually, when other markets pick up on various forms of technology and expand on different content platforms, maybe that would be a change in other markets as well, eventually.
Okay. We understand that in your next career step, you would be moving to a media agency. Now, we'd like to understand what's pulling you in that direction. Is this something to do with this shift in your attention from top down to a bottom up approach? Do you see the media agency as a more suitable place for you to engage in that sort of approach to strategy?
Mm-hmm. It's related to the previous question, actually. So because China is so platform and content, even performance driven, it is now a great time to shift into an environment where there are experts in these areas and to then help drive creativity in these environments. At the same time, because I believe in learning new things until I'm on my deathbed. So this is also a great learning opportunity for myself as well. Why I kind of actually, I've thought about this, making this move for a long time, but then why I actually did it is because in a creative agency, yes, we are aware of the different platforms, but then we don't have the resources to actually bring our ideas to life, even though we are aware of the market landscape and the different technologies and platforms. So media agencies have the resources, the connections, the network to actually do it. So therefore, the tiny detour in my career.
Interesting. So we spoke about the evolution of the agency, the evolution of the model. You're also talking about the evolution of the practitioner, if you will. This bottom-up approach, do you see as something that, say, someone who's starting out as a junior planner, is this the kind of craft they need to learn? Do you think someone, who's just at the beginning of their career would be able to, consolidate all the small pieces into a big comprehensive picture?
I would say so. I think small pieces are always useful, but then in the aspect of a bottom-up approach, recently I was introduced to the idea of media creativity. So some form of media behavior actually is so insightful that it informs the creative approach for the entire task at hand. I think it's useful to for someone who's just starting to learn things both ways. There's the classical approach of things, which is prevalent through time. It's always applicable. And at the same time, the classical approach always entail a bit more of the upstream thinking as well, which in current day we kind of sometimes neglect, thinking about the client's business, because that all starts with the broader picture of things. At the same time, it's important to balance that out with more downstream thinking, which is then, the smaller stuff in people's lives and the more granular details and, how do you leverage these as opportunities to get their attention and drive creativity.
I just have a build on this, Jocelyn, going back to something you mentioned at the beginning of our discussion, where you say you have this great, as a person, you try to be close to clients and be a partner. And does the bottom-up approach lend itself to building stronger client relations because of the sort of sense of the connection to, you know, being always on the client data or perhaps other sources of data and such? Does it feel like it's you're more therefore part of kind of one force versus, say, a top-down approach? Just curious if that has a different impact.
Yes. Yes and no. That's such a difficult question to answer. I say yes and no because the clients want a lot of stuff. They want immediate success. They also want a longer-term kind of glory in their career. So why I say yes and no? Yes, because the bottom-up approach is immediate, is fast. It's in older world language, you could say it's a little bit more tactical. So it helps them get their job done today and look good in their organization. However, the no bit is that what I have been trying to do is to remind them of longer term brand building as well. When I say the shift of from top down to bottom up, it doesn't mean I don't care about top down anymore, but then it's finding the right occasions to bring it in. We used to drive a top down because we felt like building a brand is more important than immediacy. It's now flipped around because, doing something, getting short-term gains and wins then leads to a longer-term brand building goal. So that part is something that I remind my clients of a lot of times, whenever I can, basically, because it's so easy to fall into and be addicted to the short-term excitement in things and then forget about the longer-term agenda, because that's always important to businesses. I still am a firm believer of the relationship between a good brand and business results.
Okay, that brings us very nicely to some other forms of maybe short-term excitement. One of the biggest trends in China in recent years has been the rise of brand mega collaborations, or I think brand IP you referred to it as when we spoke before, Jocelyn. Now, this is especially, I think, targeted often at the younger end of the market, what we might loosely call Gen Z or maybe younger millennials. And it's the confluence of a whole bunch of trends related to national pride, the cult of online influencers, this strong appetite for nostalgia, but also hype and novelty and, you know, something limited and exclusive. So we know, Jocelyn, you're coming up against this a lot and you have some interesting views on this phenomenon, if you like. So can you tell us more about your sort of experience on brand collabs and how you feel about this approach for brands?
Unfortunately, my view is probably not as positive as you'd like. my view is, I think people are still trying to find the right way to use these as a real opportunities. Again, I try to help people find a better way instead of mix and matching things that totally completely do not make any sense. You see chocolate bars and shoes and French fry lingerie, etc., which completely makes no sense, and it's against human cognition of things. Something that I would remind my own team of is the matching of the different brands and the product attributes. You know, there's fundamental things we can do through strategy to make this a viable opportunity. Unfortunately, I haven't had too many opportunities that to work on a great brand collaboration yet. So far, I have been tasked on a lot of things that to me don't make a lot of sense. However, looking in the market, there's been more and more success cases. I am a huge fan of local company called Perfect Diary. So it's a skincare cosmetic brand, and they've made their success through different ways. So it's their business model. And then also engaging with, to your point, Gen Z and millennials through these different collaborations. And what I really like about what they do, they've consistently done what I just said, you know, the brand matching exercise. Their brand is a lot about being artistic, and there's this very strong local flavor to their brand because it is a local brand. So these are the two attributes that they consistently leverage and anchor into, even when they're collaborating with other brands and entities. So they've done stuff like a collaboration with the Mets, so because it's artsy, and there's a sense of discovery. They've done a lot around what we call guochao, so it's China cool. There's this trend about China cool. So they've done a lot of stuff around that, collaborating with Forbidden City, local artists, etc. And it goes into their packaging, limited edition products, and then obviously social media content. I hope that I will come across opportunities like that in the future. And I do think it's an interesting way of marketing, but then it needs to be done right. Otherwise, it's just, you know, a split second of attention. You might get some, criticism and some, you know, people applauding for your bravery for doing that. And then, you know, otherwise it's, you know, money in the ocean.
I just remembered Mark Ritson recently wrote something about collaborations and the value that different co-branding exercises can can deliver to your brand. One of the points he was making was about the importance of having some a sort of contrast between the two brands that you're putting together. I think what we tend to do, and maybe it's the data's fault, or how we read the data rather, is we look for similarities. We look at what two data points have in common. We're looking for a similar target group. We're looking for a similar kind of passion point, where the value in these exercises is in the differences, in the contrast, you know, adding a different sort of equity to the brand, or reaching out to a target group that's not being a part of your brand's world. What do you think your top down approach that you described? What do you think is its role in looking at these contrasts? Assuming, of course, you agree with the role of the contrast.
Mm-hmm. Our bottom up approach.
The
bottom up. Yeah.
I think, okay, I'm going to leave top and bottom aside. I do respect that perspective. The idea of leveraging a completely different category and brand's base, you know, the base of their consumers and the basis of where they are. I appreciate that thinking. But then I'm also not a fan of facelifts. Imagine the cost of the surgeries if I change my face completely and then I have to change it back to what I originally looked like. The cost of doing that is so much more than that temporary excitement that it brings into collaborating with something so different than who you are for that momentarily kind of spike of excitement around your brand, and then having to go back to a longer term brand building. I just don't see a true ROI in that yet.
Do you think there is a case to be made for, you know, embracing collaborations for a brand that is really based on collaborations and, you know, and bringing in different influences, different elements, say the likes of, you know, street fashion brand Supreme? If you're familiar with the brand.
I am, yes. Street fashion, I think, yes. I think fundamentally I would be more receptive to collaborations that are at least in a similar space, whether from a category perspective or a need state perspective or a career industry perspective. So, for example, recently there's a collaboration between Intel and Starbucks. You know, for me, I think that's more a more natural fit, although they are quite contradictory as well. They're very different categories. Mm. But then from a consumer perspective, at least these two things kind of are, could they coexist in the same time and space in my life than, say, running shoes and a chocolate bar. I get it. But then to me, that's very unnatural.
Yeah, because I noticed there's one brand, is it Yongpu Coffee, Jocelyn, a D2C brand, and they reading an article saying they've been involved in more than 400 collaborations since they were founded in 2014. And what started as a marketing tactic actually became part of the brand. Like, this is a brand which purely exists almost through content-focused collaborations. And I wonder whether we'll see, you know, more of that, where you've kind of got these sort of challenger D2C brands where a collaboration is almost a kind of like a, it almost reminds me a little bit of that, you know, the kind of the trading, you're gradually leveraging yourself up through these collaborations to the point where you're jumping off the back of these other brands' equity to pull yourself up. Whether that works, if you're already on the other side, you've got like KFC having a collaboration with an insect repellent brand and having an insect repellent flavored drink, which just seems, you know, crazy in all sorts of levels, but I guess attention grabbing.
But you never know. I mean, even though as we speak, I have a really strong opinion around this. But if you check in again, maybe in a month or so, my opinion might change because you never know. This is what makes this market fun. You know, going back to the question around fun, everything's changing and there's no absolute answer to everything. So you always have to stay curious and always have to keep trying and find the best way around things. So maybe, you know, to your point, maybe that works. Maybe that becomes the future of marketing in China. Who knows?
This is our third and final part of our discussion with Jocelyn Tay. It's time for our quick fire round, Brand Burns. Flavor of the month is the first one. Jocelyn, can we ask you to name a brand that is or has been on your radar and why it's caught your attention? What can we learn from it?
A brand.
For any reason. Ideally, if it could be a brand that's making a splash right now in Asia or in China or in Hong Kong, that'll be great.
I think there's quite a few. So I pay attention to brands for different reasons. first reason, you know, to for work, obviously. And then another reason is, oh my God, I wish I did that too. So the second reason, I pay attention to stuff like Haiti. There are a lot of these entrepreneurs in China. They just kind of put themselves out there. And actually, success comes. So this guy became a multi-billionaire, and Haiti was listed in New York at a very young age for this guy. So I appreciate that. Through experiment and, because things are done simultaneously. So building the brand and experimenting things at the same time. He's done that very well. And there are a lot of other kind of tea houses that have done the same, which I admire a lot. I wish, you know, I don't even remember what I was doing when I was 25, probably just looking at data at my desk, right? So I wish, you know, if I had to go back in time, I wish I could do something more exciting like these guys and, you know, be remembered by a brand that is successfully built. For work-wise, so I mentioned Perfect Diary. There's so much to learn from this company because they started with a really different business model. And they've built their success around that. And to some extent, you know, although I was raised in Canada, I've been around the world, I've been kind of all over the place, but then I still, you know, in my heart, I still have this little tiny, tiny sense of Chinese pride. And so this company being so successful as a local Chinese beauty and skincare company. I admire them a lot. And you don't always see a lot of local Chinese brands giving that amount of attention on brand building and connecting with millennials and Gen Zs. at the same time. So they've done really well in terms of delivering a consistent tone of voice and a brand stance while navigating this kind of potpourri of really whimsical stuff in the market.
And it's interesting when you look at Perfect Diaries, kind of the way they talk about themselves. They talk about this idea of like unlimited beauty, and this idea of beauty not being kind of bound by, you know, by labels, and you know, by everyone sort of embracing their uniqueness, which is actually a very I mean, you at face value you kind of think that's almost a sort of Western, like Nike-esque concept in terms of the way they're approaching that, which is in itself is interesting, being born out of China.
It is. I think a lot of brands or people are still trying to learn from success in other countries, and at the same time merging that into what's happening in the lives of Chinese consumers, kind of like a hybrid approach.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go on to the second question, Jocelyn, the brand bullshit. So what do you think is overhyped or maybe getting in the way of effective work in the world of brand and marketing?
Many.
Yeah.
So we talked a lot about brand collaboration. Actually, you know, to dig that deeper a little bit, it's actually called IPs in China. So it's not necessarily just between consumer brands, but also just a legal entity, basically. A lot of bullshit I've seen in that area. For example, I have a cartoon character for adults that's used to sell infant milk formula. I've used Forbidden City to try and sell toilets. Those for me are complete
hold on.
BS. I don't know why I need to be feeling the love for China as I'm on the toilet. So for me, that completely doesn't make sense. Another thing that I think is overrated and overhyped, I think a lot of my friends would hate me for saying this, but I am not huge on creative awards anymore, because in our industry, a lot of people know this, but the work's not real. And for me, what deserves an award is if creativity drives effectiveness at the same time. I think we touched on this at the beginning of our conversation. So without that, if creativity does not drive or make any impact on business or any kind of results, then that's bullshit to me.
Mm-hmm. But to take that point a step further, so what role do you think these awards do play? Because obviously they are very prominent. There's several awards bodies now, everything from the Effies to Tangrams to, you know, the media related, you know, campaign, etc. So do you think it's a kind of a necessary step for driving, if you like, the craft for say a younger planner or even creatives for that matter? Or do you see it as maybe counterproductive? Like, I'm assuming there's pros and cons, or do you see more cons than pros?
It's easy for you to say more awards, considering you have all these awards now.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a good way to make money, right? I once wanted to invent my own award. And yeah. I think, you know, everything comes with pros and cons, obviously, despite, you know, the negativity in my voice when I talk about awards. I also do get a lot of awards because I'm tasked to. So to your question, the value of that, A, it's reputation. To individuals, to some, it might be ego. It's a recognition of their skills. But overall in an agency, we're always tasked to getting awards because it's the easiest tangible representation to our clients about the quality of our work. So it does have its value. And then on a smaller scale, it's always good to leave behind case studies for younger generations to learn what makes good work and how people judge good work in our industry. And then on an even smaller scale, it's actually a really good writing exercise for me and my team, because there's a lot of thinking that goes in behind one page of written content into an award entry. It's a really good exercise to help my team, especially younger people on my team, to think about post-rationalize or reverse engineer the business challenge, and then the insights, and then therefore the creativity that would help address the challenge. It's a really good exercise for my team.
Fantastic. Jocelyn, we're coming to the final part here, which we've called fortunate failure. Don't mean to end on a downer, sort of on a more kind of, you know, human level. So looking back at your career, think of when you had a big mistake or a failure, perhaps that ended up ultimately becoming the basis, the foundation for future success or positive outcome in the end.
I'm trying to think of a big one, but I cannot because I've made so many mistakes in my career. And maybe I make mistakes every day, but then I think this is a really good element to success in the future. I think it's important to know your mistakes and be aware of them and learn from them. I think, you know, it's as cliche as it sounds, but it's really important for industry because I previously mentioned there's no fixed formula to what I do, to what we do. There's so many different solutions to the same task or problem that we need to solve. So it's really important to test and try different things and learn from it. Or are you looking for one huge mistake?
No, take one. I think it's a very healthy approach. I think we've all, you know, worked, you know, in or with the industry, and we know, you know, you were talking about the ego. So I think it's definitely a very healthy approach to think about the industry, you know, in a way, you know, how we can make things better, you know, how we can do things in a different way. And I think your Jackson Pollock approach is, you know, is a testament to that too.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Jocelyn, so as a final bonus question, we're actually planning to run a mini series focused around the central theme of foods. And this is where we're going to look at the kind of intersection between food, culture, technology, especially through the lens of Asia. So we were curious, and I know you've actually mentioned restaurants and food a few times in the interview, so I suspect there may be a passion of some sort there. But, you know, when it comes to China or Hong Kong, what do you think would be interesting to explore? You know, are there particular trends or topics around food which you find interesting right now?
I love this topic. I love it so much more than talking about my career. Food is such an intrinsic part of Asian culture, as you know. And a lot of our perspectives and the way we behave is actually highly related to our interaction with food. The dinner table, for example, you know, the best dinner is never just about what's on the table, but it's what's around it. So it's about the people and how, and, you know, the time we have enjoying the food together. So our culture is really, food is a big part of our culture. And then what I would be interested in is I recently started to feel very sad because as a result of COVID, I guess, and maybe, you know, the economy turning a little bit less positive, a lot of legacy food, I wouldn't say manufacturers, but outlets are closing down because the really traditional food formats and way of making things is highly labor intensive. It's in a, you know, it's not the best experience. So young generations do not want to get into it. But then it's such a kind of unique and special art in these legacy kind of foods. And it's very sad that they're closing down. I do wonder if technology could help them sustain in a certain way. I don't even know if we can 3D print that stuff. But then it'll be nice to see, help, you know, find a way to help these guys survive. You know, they all started out of passion, and I think, you know, passion is a great thing.
Yeah, it's really interesting because there's been something in Singapore, the Singapore restaurant rescue group, where there's been actually a sort of researcher friend of ours that we've had on the podcast was a sort of leading figure in it, and just basically, you know, trying to help the hawkers and the traditional, you know, often owned by you know elderly owners that are maybe not tech familiar, and trying to help them get on board with the delivery apps, etc. And I think we were also talking about this the other day, and how there's almost this tension with the younger generation of, you know, they sort of want to preserve and maintain that part of culture. There's almost a sort of even a guilt attached to that. But I feel that, you know, at the same time, they, you know, how token is that? How genuine is that effort versus, do they really sort of understand what they'd be losing if these establishments were to disappear, and even the recipes and the dishes that they're obviously true to. Yeah, how does that figure in somewhere like Hong Kong, or do you feel there's something similar going on in terms of dynamic with the younger generation?
I think it's quite similar. There are talks around preserving these things, and you know, the whole "I love Hong Kong," the whole, like I mentioned, the Lion Rock spirit. You know, all these establishments were formed because of that spirit. You know, back in the day, you know, just kind of roll up your sleeves and do it. So there are a lot of talks around it. But again, I think similar to what you said about the hawkers, I'm not sure. I'm not clear on the depth of involvement of the younger generation actually trying to help preserve that kind of industry. And I'm not sure about the proportion of it being an authentic something they want to do from their heart versus, you know, something that's just kind of talk. It's got talk value.
Yeah, because you've actually had brands here like Tiger Beer actually trying to push that movement, if you like, to celebrate, you know, the hawker heroes, if you will, because they recognize the sort of cultural value and passion point. But it's, yeah, it'd be interesting to see how that really connects at a deeper level. Anyway, we digress, Jocelyn, but really interesting to touch and to end on that note.
Yeah, I'd love to talk more about food next time.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, thanks for stirring the pots with us today. We've had a great fail. I hope you're feeling well-fed and nourished yourself.
Definitely.
Fantastic.
Yeah, thanks so much, Jocelyn. Please don't forget to subscribe to the pods. Keep the feedback coming and look out for our next episode related to sports marketing with Professor Simon Chadwick.
So in the meantime, keep it brewing.